Hello, listeners. Today we're going to be talking about Fantomas, the arch-criminal anti-hero. And joining me for this episode is Master of Disguise, Emma Gerard. Hi, Emma.
Please take my calling card. It has invisible ink.
And returning guest, Lord of Terror, Genius of Evil, Dave Eves. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I'm glad I did not get stuck with Fandor or Juve. I'm at least competent now.
Right. Well, today we're going to be talking about the original Fiard Fantomas serial. It's like five films, each of which would have been broken up into several episodes. I think different episodes depending on the runtime of each film. But they began in 1913 and ran into 1914. And they're the first of Louis Fiard, the big famous silent serials, which included Le Vampire and Jude X. Although one thing I found out is that he had earlier serials that just aren't really as famous, or some might be lost, but he had comedy serials, he had all kinds of things. But
did over like close to 700 movies. It's insane what this guy made.
Although that might be counting like, you know, one reel things.
And true.
Like, depending how you break up Fantomas, the first film could be three episodes, second one was four episodes, third one was six episodes, fourth one was four episodes, and fifth one is four episodes also. So, you know, if you count each episode as its own thing, I think the filmography gets padded out pretty quick.
Hey, I'm counting IMDb, and IMDb is never wrong.
Right. But I think these are probably the most famous of his films because they've been revisited and remade, you know, along with Le Vampire and Jude X. You know, the images are still recognizable even to this day. I think, like, even before I'd ever even heard of Fantomas, I'd seen the Magritte painting that was sort of based on it. I don't know if either of you have seen that, but that was kind of my just introduction to the iconography of Fantomas.
That is that the original cover of him looming over the city of Paris?
Yeah.
That painting is amazing. It's also my understanding that that's how the name Fantomas was cemented in, because it was originally Fantomos or something, and he misheard them when he was doing the painting and called him Fantomas.
I like Fantomas. It's Thomas with Phantom in it, so
it's so silly yet sounds so serious because it's European. Like, if there was a dude named Ghostifer, it'd be like, no, I'm not taking it seriously.
It's almost as good as Bob Tom.
Bob Tom is my favorite disguise. It's Bob Tom from New York.
Oh, he has to be American. His name is Bob Tom.
That sounds American, right? Right, let's go with that. Nobody will ever question it,
because these movies are based on a series of novels written by two people that would turn out like a 400-page novel once a month. So I don't think they had any time to check anything. And what really adds to the very convoluted sense of the Fantomas allure is the fact that they would each write one chapter. I don't think they would just kind of like this is where it's going to end up. You write chapter one, I'll do the chapter two. You do all the odds, I'll do all the evens. And I don't think they ever really met in the middle to be like, how's this going to work together?
I mean, just going by the films, it sort of has that feel sometimes, like they're skipping huge chunks between stories. Like in one, he's escaped, and then the next one he's in prison, and they don't really explain how that happened, and apparently it's just covered in one of the books. But you know, it's sort of a strange experience. If you watch them all together, it doesn't flow like one big long story the way you might expect. Actually, you know, it's just each episode's sort of like its own, you know, based on one of the books, and it's its own thing. And I even heard that they would hand out leaflets when people went to see these in the theater that would explain what the plot was. So people would actually go in knowing the plot. It would be like if you went to see the new Avengers movie and they gave you like a little leaflet giving you all the spoilers ahead of time so you weren't surprised when they came up.
I'll quote the guy that does the commentary in Fantomas. This is the adolescence of cinema. We're not in the infancy anymore. We're kind of getting a little bit closer into story structure. This is still very much experimental in terms of telling a narrative story. There are long scenes without intertitles of people just talking without any context being given. I think you were expected to kind of know going in what is happening on the screen. Everyone read the books. Everyone loved the books. Everyone loved the character. You have these leaflets. I think without that, it's almost just like kind of what is going on here. I don't think it detracts from it, though, from a 21st century standpoint. It's still interesting to watch, but I can definitely see with how they presented it on the screen, the necessity or the desire maybe to provide some additional context outside of what is actually being projected.
Right. Emma, how do you find that they play today?
I think they still play. I mean, like, you know, it was 5 movies, so, you know, there were some that I liked better than others, like you would expect with, like, I don't know, Fast and the Furious or something like that. Maybe I'm not the best person to ask because I feel like I watch a lot of silent movies where people spend long takes standing around and talking without intertitles. But no, I think like all like the action kind of scenes like really worked. I think the humor still comes across, which like a big part of it because it's also like, come on, it's like the story of a guy who's main thing is that he's an evil master of disguise.
He can be anyone at any time.
He can only be stopped by someone who's not quite as good at disguising.
Those long take tableaus that are kind of characteristic of silent cinema of that time, like we've talked before about the difference between, you know, silent films from the 1910s versus like a silent film from 1929. So you do get a lot of these like long takes, but Fjord, you know, apparently he was a pioneer of this le film esthétique, and they were supposed to be very visually dynamic and visually interesting films. So, like, I don't know, it's almost like the predecessor to cinéma de look. You think of all the 1980s kind of stylish French movies, La Femme Nikita, like, maybe he was the progenitor for that. But,
yeah,
you know,
and the more that's happening in the movie, the more stylish it does get, like, the exposition is a little flat compared to like the chase scenes.
Sure, like the whole sequence on the train was really cool, and yeah, like, the mixture of like a miniature, which plus I think footage of a real train crash. Yes. So it's all mixed together,
which I'm sure was just plentiful at the time. It's like, we need a train crash, just go out and find one. I'm sure there's 7 today.
Right.
I'm surprised they didn't employ more miniature-esque type things, though, throughout the series. I feel like that's the only time it really happens. Not that you really need much more. The best stuff is really just the interplay and the cat and mousery between Fantomas and Juve and Fandor. But that was a nice touch in the second one when we had the train sequence happening.
I think that's also the one that ends with the big explosion. So that one's pretty action-packed all around.
Yeah.
There's that whole sequence of Fantomas like hiding under the water with the
wine bottle.
Yeah, the wine bottle with the hole in it so you can breathe air, and then, you know, big explosion and cliffhanger ending.
He's always like 7 steps ahead. He's like, what if I have to hide in this this basin of water? I got it. Wine bottle that's hollow. What if I get captured by my 2 nemesises? I know, fake arms.
The fake arms is my favorite. It's so funny when it happens.
Because prior to that, he's using his arms.
It's true.
Well, in his defense, how else are you supposed to get away from 2 men just walking you down the street?
But in later things, he's very adept at getting away from them without the use of fake limbs. He can just push them aside and they fall into traps that he's already laid, like pits in the ground that he's put grass over.
My favorite one is that it's like the end of the movie and they're like, you know, you've come to an end now, Fantomas. And he goes through like a trick wall and they're like, oh, I guess that's it.
They don't even try to go after him.
Well, it's sort of funny. Like, usually, you know, you think like serialized kind of like pulpy crime stories, you're rooting for the hero and it's like, oh, the villain just slipped through his grasp. Here, you're kind of rooting for Fantomas, right? Like, he's the main appeal of these stories. His name's in the title and he's the interesting one.
Hey, Juve is a very, very compelling...
Is it Juve or Juve?
Based on, because I've been watching the 1960s ones, which are very, very special movies. It's pronounced Juve.
Okay, all right. I wasn't sure, just going by the silent.
It's like, wait, how do you actually pronounce this? No, they pronounce it Juve in those. We'll talk about the 60s ones later, because I have plenty to say about those.
Oh, I'm curious about the flying car.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, I was wondering if maybe like contemporary audiences really liked Fandor for some reason, because there's like 2 movies where, you know, like Juve is, you know, for whatever reason can't be on the case, and so like we spend half the movie watching Fandor being like surprised to find dead bodies and like just kind of crawling around looking for Phantomas.
I think of the two of them, Fandor's clearly the more capable one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's kind of the sidekick, but at the same time, like, he's a crime reporter, which is sort of more interesting somehow. And I don't, like, it made me think of like a lot of pulpy stories where you have like a journalist investigating something, or, you know, even like Lois Lane in the Superman cartoons or comics, mm-hmm. kind of finding out what the villain is and going into their lair. Like, Fandor's a little bit of that.
And in the 60s ones, Fandor is the main character, basically, except for Phantomas. Phantomas is always the main character, but Fandor's next, more so than Juve.
Okay. That sort of makes sense, because, like, Juve, he's a little bit older, and he's sort of like the cop who can't quite keep up sometimes.
Well, they do cast a not that young Jean Marseille as Fandor, okay. and a Phantomas.
Oh, he plays both?
He plays both parts.
Oh, that's actually kind of wild.
And the best thing is, it's really done for no real reason.
Well, you would think there would be some kind of big reveal at the end. And I like, just going by the silent ones, you know, there's sometimes mistaken identity, or like each sort of swiping another identity. So at one point you have, you know, which Phantomas is the real Phantomas. Like, you think there could be some fun like that in the 60s ones.
In the 60s ones, Phantomas does spend a considerable amount of time disguised as Fandor. So I thought that's why they did it. But then he spends another considerable amount of time disguised as Juve. So it's like, it makes no difference who's playing him. I think that Jean Marseille was just like, you can either play Phantomas or Fandor. And he said, yes, both, please.
There's a couple of different versions that came after. Like, there was the, I saw there was an American remake in the 1920s that's apparently lost. And apparently not good. And then there's also like the made for TV ones where Claude Chabrol directed some, and Luis Manuel's son directed some. So I was kind of curious to check those out too. But
those are supposed to be very faithful to the serial, and they're set still in like the 1913 era. So they're supposed to be a direct kind of remake of the original films.
Right. Like the 60s ones, they look very like James Bond, Batman kind of inspired.
It's campy. It's like the Pink Panther meets James Bond meets Batman. And not to say that it's not campy on its own regard. This is just so much that it's like, we're going to write it into a corner, and it's the next guy's problem to figure out how we're going to write it out of it.
Sure. I mean, like, some of the details are so strange that they really stick out in my mind. I was joking before about the anti-snake pajamas
that don't work.
The best thing is, I don't think he knew what was coming for him. He just thought, I'm murder proof now, I got spiky pajamas on. And then a snake came and is like, oh no, I can't do a thing.
Oh, they, I think they really kill a snake too, it looks like. That,
yeah, they definitely
yeah.
Did you play the video game Elevator Action when you were a kid?
I have never even heard of Elevator Action.
No idea.
It was kind of like the first movie.
There is a, I have to assume they just redressed the same set, like just put in a separate number there, move the camera slightly so it looks like it's a different location.
Mm-hmm. Elevators are new. The audiences will be wowed. Endless elevator action.
Well, can we speak for a second about the introduction of Phantomas to the film world? Because this is supposed to be a master criminal, master of disguise, serial killer. The first thing he does is hide behind a curtain to steal a necklace. It's such like an unimpressive start to, and it ends pretty dark and grisly. But it's like, oh, this guy, all he has to do is hide behind a curtain. You never knew he was there.
Yeah. I mean, they build him up over time, it sort of seems like. And I don't, like, the first one's probably the weakest one, right?
Really like the stuff with the act. In that one, he obviously has the big persona that has in that is Gurn, who has a wig and a mustache, and that is Lady Beltham's lover.
Well, and then you have the actor Val Grant playing Phantomas, or like a character based on Phantomas, on the stage, and it's like costume disguises and sort of putting the theatricality within the film and playing with that stuff. Like, that's pretty interesting, yeah.
And especially when Phantomas' big plan is to have him switched out with the actor so that the actor will get murdered instead of him, even though they figure it out at the last second. Spoilers for this over 100-year-old movie.
That's true. That is a pretty nefarious thing to do.
And apparently in the books, the actor actually gets guillotined.
Yeah, they changed it for the film, I guess, just...
They thought it was too dark. They wanted to do that, but they were told like, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple darker things in it. Like, there's that glove made of human skin.
Yeah, they're just gonna wear his hands.
Oh my god, I forgot about that.
Or like the whole like murderous corpse thing. Like, there's some Grand Guignol kind of stuff in there.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of grisly details explained like via print, like the newspaper after the explosion. Like, we found plenty of charred bodies, grisly entrails, all this terrible stuff. It's like, I can't believe they got away with writing that in this for 1913. You don't really see too much on the screen. It's mostly something that is described. I would say the grisliest thing is seeing them peel the gloves off of Fantomas, and they're obviously supposed to be human skin that he's put on his hands.
Right.
Which I'm going to say is a fun plot for like 1913. Like, fingerprint analysis is probably very new, and they keep finding a dead man's fingerprints at every crime scene. And it's just like, they're just using his fingerprints. They're just using his fingerprints. They're just using his fingerprints. Like, oh, and that's what they ended up doing. I feel like it seems less, I don't want to say magical, but less mysterious in this day and age. But you can still see the appeal and the horror and the intrigue that could have existed in 1913 when they made that.
Right.
I'm interested in the idea that, like, you know, the world was less image saturated back then, and people weren't as easily like upset by imagery that they saw. You know, like Lifesavers candy was invented because the Titanic sank, and they were like, oh, if everyone's talking about the Titanic and they see Lifesavers candies, and they'll buy it. And it worked. Like, people weren't like, that's offensive. They were like, oh yeah, it's like the Titanic candy. And oh, in these movies, like, you know, if you a movie reused, like, well, actually, I guess sometimes they do like reuse footage from like real world tragedies, and like kind of tends to upset people. But I don't know, people weren't like thinking in that same way that we do now.
Oh no, Fantomas is going after the Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
That would explain everything.
It would. He's the cause of World War I. I have heard a lot of analysis is because Fantomas is a character that's been tried to be they've tried to resurrect him multiple times, and sometimes not to his greatest success, because the whole idea from 1913 of a evil genius trying to take over France is novel then, but after it actually happened in World War II, it becomes far less of a novelty and something that's like, let's not do that again. Let's not talk about that. That wasn't fun the first time. And I think it also depends on the level of seriousness it's taken. Like, the 60s ones are obviously very comedic, very goofy, with Fantomas being the only really serious character. And he's doing it still in a campy way of like a James Bond villain. It very much feels like a, literally, more so than James Bond, more so like Austin Powers. When you do it like that, it becomes fun again. But like, in 1913, it kind of feels like, especially since you're not supposed to really know Fantomas' real face or real identity, he can be anyone. He's like a personification of crime, basically. Mm-hmm. And crime is something that's on the rise in that age with industrialization. People are living in cities again, close quarters. Crime is becoming more of a rampant thing. Police officers are needed to solve these crimes. Detective stories are becoming popular. And to have them fight against the ultimate criminal is such a fun idea.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. That's definitely the appeal of Fantomas. How do you think he fits in as like a pulp character or like a supervillain type character into some of the things that came later on? Like, again, I'm sort of thinking of like superhero comic books or detective stories that would come later on that are also more pulpy.
I mean, for one thing, he doesn't really need any kind of motivation. Like, he's got kind of like these separate little schemes here and there that the hero needs to stop. Mm-hmm. But we don't need to like have like a really complex understanding of why Fantomas does the things that he does. I think that's usually a characteristic of comic book villains.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have an MO. It's like, well, today I'm stealing jewels. Tomorrow I'm murdering everybody.
It's just his goal is to get away with the crime. That's all it is. And it doesn't even really matter what crime. And, you know, it has that kind of, you know, I would have gotten away with it too if it wasn't for you meddling Jouvet, like, or Jouve, sorry. But
I agree. It sounds like it should be Jouvet. I was calling him Juvie. I feel like it's a fun little nickname for him, Juvie.
Well, and now, like, Fandor, I just think of, like, this
the streaming service.
Streaming service, yeah.
You have to assume it's named after the character Fandor, right?
I think so. I would guess so.
it seems like something that Fandor, the streaming service, would do. It's like just in enough without being too like opaque to not figure it out.
Right. It's a good little wink for cinephiles.
I just had a horrible thought.
Sure.
That if Fantomas was like a superhero series that came out now, there would be people online called the Fandomas.
Yeah.
Sorry. I had to get that out of my brain.
I can imagine if this existed now, there'd be people like, oh, you know what? Fantomas has a point. I think he's a really good character that people should look up to.
Fantomas
was right t-shirts. Yeah.
Yeah. People idolizing him like they idolized the Joker or something.
I'm like, when you put it that way, what's his name? Killmonger? Oh my god, like he is Fantomas, right? Because like he's right until the point where he kills this like security guards. Like, you don't need to kill art guards to steal art, believe me.
I mean, one thing that certainly separates Fantomas from most supervillains, like you said, the motive. He's a cipher. He just exists to serve his own purpose. Although in the books, they do kind of go into his backstory a little bit. And this is a fun fact that I learned. At one point, it's revealed that Fandor is supposed to be his son and that Yuv is supposed to be his brother. But as quickly as it's brought up, it's dropped and never mentioned again.
I feel like a lot of serialized stories do this thing where like eventually everyone has to be related, and then like you realize how quickly it falls apart. Yeah. Yeah. You know, like Darth Vader being Luke's father, that's sort of the famous one, but like as soon as you know, you push that and it's like, oh, he also made C-3PO and Luke and Leia are twins, it starts to make the world feel really, really small. Like, it might make a certain thematic sense if Fantomas and Juve were brothers, but you know, it's sort of one of those things where literally like I'm not sure how into it that I am.
I'd say the best example of that not working would be like Halloween. It's interesting for Halloween 2 that Jamie Lee Curtis and Michael Myers are siblings, but then it doesn't work as well, except for maybe H2O. I like H2O, but like them dropping it for the new Halloween wasn't the worst idea in the world. I think it allowed them to have a little bit more creative freedom.
Mm-hmm. I like that new Halloween film, like talking about masked evildoers.
Oh, yeah, there's another masked killer.
Yes. I like in the have you seen the new Halloween, Emma?
Yeah, I really liked it.
I like when he gets loose, Jamie Lee Curtis thinks like, oh, he's coming to get me, and it's like for years and years she's just been thinking that he's out to get her. And he doesn't even think about her. He just goes on this killing spree, and it's like it's completely randomized, just out to kill.
But... And the only reason that he ends up where she is because everyone else is obsessed with that fandom as well, and that connection that they're pushing him towards her. Right. No, I that's one element of that I really think worked very well, and I think it's one that doesn't get enough credit.
Yeah, it's the fact that it's an actual fan, like a fanatic who has to bring them together at the end. I don't like just the sort of presence of these shadowy evildoers as figures in literature is always sort of interesting, or film, of course, since that's what we're talking about. But you know, like Fantomas, the way he dresses up his costume, like I like his all black outfit when he's,
oh yeah,
yeah,
his ninja garb.
Yeah, sort of proto ninja outfit. But you know,
my favorite is when there's three people dressed as Fantomas in going to a party.
Right, the party scene's fantastic too, like the like masked gown kind of sequence. And it's sort of funny that even within the world of these films, like Fantomas seems to be like a popular figure. He's got plays based on him, and I know like in real life that there was like a huge fandom for Fantomas, and riots started when people would see the actor in the streets and stuff like that. Like it was a huge deal. So it's sort of funny just in the serials, characters reacting or characters kind of responding to the pulp phenomenon of Fantomas in their own way.
But you would think the thing that doesn't, like, you and I and the three of us outside would realize, if you and I and Fantomas are all at this party dressed the same, how am I going to know if I'm speaking with you, who's another cop, or Fantomas? You realize that suddenly your plan falls apart because there's no accountability anymore. And that is the entire reason why the police force is completely inept in the entire series.
Sure. And that's that like kind of costumed ball is something that keeps coming up in these like Fouillard serials, and and there's a really good one in the 1960s remake of Judex.
Oh yeah,
where they all have the bird head costumes.
I love that scene.
But and it's always like great, you know, who's the hero, who's the villain? They're all dressed up. You're not necessarily sure. Fantomas, it's a little bit different because they tell you ahead of time, visually, what the costumes are, what the disguises are, which is a sort of interesting device.
I think it's necessary because there's only one of them where they don't do that. The third one, the murderous corpse one, where they don't show you Fantomas's disguises ahead of time. And they do it because Juve is in a dumb costume the entire movie. And it's like, well, that's obviously it's obviously him.
I thought it was so they wouldn't spoil the ending, but
I figured they didn't want to spoil the ending, but I started to believe that any tall, skinny dude with a larger nose was Fantomas. Like, oh, Fantomas. That's not Fantomas? Oh, wait, no, that's not Fantomas either. I suspected everyone in that one to be Fantomas.
Well, also, too, the way it's shot, like, again, it's a little bit further back. There aren't many close-ups at all. You really do have a hard time kind of guessing who's who. There's no sound to identify, you know, oh, like, clearly that's their voice. They do make it a little bit tricky sometimes to see, you know. So by showing you ahead of time what the costumes are, you can kind of identify them quickly when they actually pop up the episode.
And it's fun to be like, oh, all a sneak peek of what you will see.
Right. It's sort of teasing you. And like that just makes me think of all the Mission Impossible, you know, the TV show and the movies where they have these costumes and like masks that they pull off.
Clearly where they're taking that from.
Right. I think it's probably fair to call like Fantomas one of these seminal crime stories. You know, you see, like, it almost feels like redundant to kind of point out, like, oh, that reminds me of this or that, because, you know, there's a little bit of Fantomas all over the place.
There's a little bit of Fantomas in all of us.
Sure.
I would say, like,
you have the right hat.
Yeah. Or the right fake beard, fake mustache combo. I would say, like, one of the most obvious influences is probably on the Dr. Mabuse movies, which also saw a resurgence in the 60s alongside Fantomas. But, right. Dr. Mabuse the Gambler, like, the opening of that is him showing off his various disguises, just like Fantomas.
Right, right. And how do you find that the 1960s ones compared to the silent versions, Dave? Are they totally bonkers, or...
Totally bonkers. I feel like they capture the right spirit, though. Well, first and foremost, Juve is completely inept. Not just, like, looking back from now, I mean, like, what is he doing? Why did he release Fantomas from prison? He killed someone. The blood is on your hands, Juve. Juve is legitimately like a buffoon. He's played like a buffoon. Fandor is a hack journalist that makes up stories, and that's how he gets brought into the whole Fantomas thing, because he publishes a fake interview with Fantomas, because he doesn't believe that Fantomas is real. And because of that, Fantomas feels like he's embarrassed him, so he's like, oh, I'm going to commit crimes dressed like you so I can embarrass you. But then he does the same thing as Juve, because Juve has been annoying him, and then they are both arrested for being Fantomas, spoilers, and then they have to team up to try to take him down. But they're wacky, they're far more comedic, but I think they still capture that, like, costumey ridiculousness.
Fantomas has like a really strange mask in it, where all I see when I look at that is the Beast from the original Beauty and the Beast. Like, if you pulled off all the fur and fangs, like, that's what would be underneath.
And it's still Jean Mercier.
I know, like, you just see the shape of his head, and it's like, now that's all I can think of when I see that Beauty and the Beast is like, if you pop the top of his head off, that's what would be inside.
It wouldn't surprise me if they're just like, what do we use as a mask? Oh, this one decayed over time. It's blue. Let's use it.
Like, I don't, it sort of has like weird angles to it, and
but it looks very fake except for his eyes, because it's actually his eyes, and I have no idea how they made that meet his eyes so well, because everything else looks very much like a Halloween mask.
I mean, that's similar to the Beauty and the Beast costume, where like his eyes really just stand out.
Yeah,
and you know, that's kind of what sells that performance. It's you know, some real eyes coming through. It's not just like a rubber head on a stick or I don't know what. But they look fun to me, like flying cars and stuff. It's just definitely, they look very 60s and very kind
of... I've watched two of them now. I really love things from that era where they'll have like Jean Mercier was like 51 in those movies, yet he's supposed to be the young dashing hero. And it's like, dude, you are clearly a middle-aged man right now. But his checkered sport jacket game is on point. I will give him that.
Okay. And do you mind Juve and Fandor as heroes in the silent version, Emma, or like are they just totally a joke basically?
I mean, yeah, I kind of think they're a joke, but I think it's just one of those things where the villain is just way more interesting than the heroes. Like, I think you're still supposed to be on their side, because otherwise in, like, a whole movie where they're trying to, like, clear Juve's name doesn't really work. Yeah.
Right. By the time you get to Judex, it's sort of like a version of Fantomas where Fantomas is the hero. Like, Judex is kind of the heroic version of that, where he's also wearing disguises and jumping through secret passages and that sort of thing, except he's doing it in the name of good, and he's a hero. So I don't know, it's almost as if like you had to find a way to rework Fantomas to be a heroic figure. And of course, like Vampire, the most famous thing out of that is the Musidora, the Irma Vep character, being bad, dressed up like a giant bat, and or you know, in that like bodysuit. It's similar to the Fantomas costume, and it's, you know, she's also the villain, but she's cool, you know, the villain's the cool one. So yeah, it's sort of interesting to see in all these serials, like eventually, yeah, like Judex, it's the more I think about it, the basically just like, oh, you know, Judex is Fantomas but good, he's a good guy now.
it's so amazing what the level of popularity that these serials had, though. Like the Les Vampires in America was released as a Fantomas sequel,
right?
Even though Fantomas is clearly not in it, they had to pose it as such.
But it totally works like that. Like, hey, you like Fantomas? Here's more of that. It's just like another thing that's almost the same. So,
although yeah, in that one, I would say the heroes are slightly more capable. Even though I can't remember the name of the sidekick in that. The sidekick is clearly more capable than the hero actually is.
Right, that's sort of a recurring thing.
But... you could almost say, though, and I don't think they were actually going for it, but in the fifth one, after Fantomas has literally been arrested in Belgium for a crime we haven't seen and is sentenced to life in prison, and Juve is just like, he's going to get out, so I'm just going to let him out. It's like, how obsessed with catching this guy are you? And he does, and then, like I said, Fantomas just murders someone when he gets out, and Juve is in prison for him. It's like, did you really think this plan out?
No. Well, like, I think it's even in the first episode where he's, like, daydreaming about Fantomas, and that's one of the final images in it. He's completely obsessed with him. Like, it's supposed to be more that he has this obsession, and then he just...
I do appreciate
let it go.
They do kind of mirror that in the at the very end of the final serial, in the very end of the first one, with Fantomas putting his hands out crossed, like, go ahead, catch me, even though he does eventually get away.
But, like, that sort of cat and mouse, like, fascination, but also I want to catch you thing, like, that's, you know, sort of the interesting dynamic of it that kind of keeps, presumably kept people coming back to see more back in the day.
I'm jumping around here. I'm going back to the first one. So obviously in the first one, Fantomas is in disguise as this Gurren character that he's created. Mm-hmm. He's wearing a wig and a mustache. They send him to jail. He has to maintain that disguise while he's in jail. You never see like the spirit gum wearing off of his mustache. You never see him with a bottle of it. He maintains that level of disguisery the entire time.
That's what separates him from the amateur
in
disguise, is his secret gum formula.
Permanent gum formula. Even Lady Beltham can't see through it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he's the master of disguise. He's not just the regular guy of disguise.
Yeah. And also in the fifth one, after he murders someone's like, oh, good thing I have a disguise that looks just like this guy in my bag.
He probably has a disguise for everyone.
He can become anyone that he wants. The one thing I will say that the 60s serial is definitely trying to maintain with the blue mask is the sense that in the books you never actually are supposed to see Fantomas' real face. in the serials, that's kind of like unavoidable because you have one actor playing him. So that's why they do the blue mask thing. It's like, you'll never see what he really looks like. If at all, the most you'll see of him is this face that he's chosen to portray himself as. Although something tells me if you take it off, he looks just like Jean Mercier.
Right. But that element that's sort of interesting, that like it definitely would work better in a book than a film. But, you know, this idea that like he could really look like anyone and you don't know what his real face is, and he could kind of blend into a crowd or come out or be the person next to you. And that kind of quality is very sort of exciting and mysterious, and you could do a lot with that kind of goes out the window, like you said, when you start making a film version where you need to cast an actor and you can only maybe do so much with costumes. Like, they have a lot of fun with the costumes. You can see just the range and creativity of some of them. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's like you might as well let the audience in on that and let them know who it is instead of trying to make it a reveal. Like, I don't know, the only other way around that would maybe cast multiple actors as Fantomas and...
That, I think, without sound, that would get so incredibly confusing. That would get so incredibly confusing, quickly.
Yeah. You know, today, like, maybe you could do it that way or something like that.
I think that would kind of work. Like they do in the Mission Impossible movies, just like you said earlier. Once they put on the fake face, they literally are somebody else. Yeah. Except for occasionally when it's just Tom Cruise in, like, old man makeup or something.
You get those, like, really cool 30 seconds where you have Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
It's really funny for like a short moment, but you'd probably have to do something like that if you were going to do it today. Maybe they wouldn't work today. Like sometimes you watch a silent film, you say, oh, like you could probably refresh in that and it would be good to go. Like, and maybe the character you could do a version of today, but the story is as is. Like if you know, even if you did it as a period piece, it would probably be hard to impress audiences today, I think.
I don't know.
I think a big part of that is just because everything from this serial has become stolen and reused so many times by so many different things. It will almost inevitably seem derivative.
Right.
Like, this whole thing about being more fascinated with the villain is, like, pretty widely accepted in film viewers now.
especially comic book movies.
Yeah, I think like the turn of the century, you know, like the idea of like the public fascination with like serial killers and things like that was kind of new. And so, you know, moving away from fictions that were generally just either kind of like melodramas or what's the word I'm looking for, where it's like a really just like a long story of somebody's life.
The biopics or?
Yeah, like they're just kind of like moving away from that. In this new media,
do a biopic of Fantomas, but make it seem like he was a real person that really existed. Yuv and Fandor were real and always on his tail, but he was always one step ahead of them.
Yeah, I don't really
always
mean...
played by a different actor.
Yeah, I don't really mean biopic. I mean like, you know, like, there's this novel, like older novels that are just like,
oh, I
you know the story of this woman, and she like, it's like from her birth until her like slow.
Right.
Decay as a washerwoman or whatever, and all of the like horrible things that happened to her along the way.
Just like Fantomas is like a Flaubert novel or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Like one thing I sort of thought of watching these are the some of the Jacques Cravat films, like especially Out One, where that's also kind of this big serialized story, or Le Pont du Nord kind of has some weird pulpy elements like a spider web gun and kung fu and stuff like that thrown into. But I don't know, like Out One, the kind of pulpy elements that are introduced, you know, people running on the rooftops with the masks and pistols, like it's almost like Rivette was more interested in the kind of atmosphere and sense of distrust and paranoia than like actually the characters, you know. And it's like, if you watch Out One, it's like, oh, you know, certain segments, they have like the vibe of a old serial more than actually trying to imitate it or trying to do like a real plotty story. It's just like creating a feeling of you know, watching these kinds of serials, which I thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, there's a lot of things you could kind of take away from it. And, you know, just thinking of the place they would have had in French pop culture, like, you know, you're going to see it sort of reemerge at certain points in time. like the 1960s, for whatever reason, it seemed like a lot of these silent stories were being revitalized. I don't know if it's because you had filmmakers who were, you know, young, who maybe saw them, you know, as kids who were nostalgic, or, you know, but what the exact rationale was, why 40 years later, you know, you have a Fantomas and Jude X,
or and even Dr. Like, Mabuse.
Even Dr. Mabuse, like, you know, they all kind of come back at a certain point. You know, I'm not sure exactly. Maybe the rights were all coming to an end. I don't know. Like, there might be, like, some explanation like that. But, like, one thing I really like about the Jude X film is it kind of takes a little bit from Le Vampire and Fantomas 2, and it just sort of amalgamates it all and kind of creates its own story from it. It's like, I'll just cherry pick the best parts and kind of tie it all together.
I mean, that film just seems like a love letter to the early teens serial films. I'm sure mostly by Fouillade, which Franju had grown up watching. But no, I love that movie. I feel nostalgic watching it, even though I obviously did not grow up in the 19-teens or anything, or in France.
No, like, after watching it, it makes me want to go back and watch stuff like Fantomas and just kind of experience that more, and, you know, the feeling of, like, you know, heroes and villains dressed all in black, and, you know, that sort of simplicity. I think there's definitely an appeal to, like, not to say that Fantomas is totally simple, like, there's like a weird convoluted quality to it too, but just, you know,
but it still has, like, this weird, like, 1960s mod thing going on, especially in some of the costumes. It feels both modern and archaic at the same time. It's such a fascinating blend of everything together. Mm-hmm. And not to jump back to your previous point, I think a Jacques Rivette Fantomas would be absolutely fascinating, because I don't think anyone would play Fantomas. I don't think there would be a Fantomas, or if there was, you would never actually see him. It would just be
they would all talk about Fantomas, and it's like, wait, like, is he one of the characters who was already introduced? Wait, who's playing Fantomas? And you would find out, like, at the end, when you have to look it up on Wikipedia, that, like, oh, he chose not to put Fantomas in the film as a creative choice, and they all talk about it.
Perfect for Rivette's, like, whole paranoia thing, though, is if Fantomas may or may not just be a creation of Jules' imagination.
Right. that would be the sort of 1960s, like, serious art house take on it.
Yeah, as opposed to the one we got instead.
Just also, like, thinking of the way Batman was done in the 1960s, like, it's hard for me not to compare, because I like Batman, but you know, to see it kind of redone in the sort of colorful comedic way, like, it seems a little bit like that to me. And just thinking of how Batman's been done in the years since, you know, Fantomas doesn't have the same kind of popularity, or, you know, a comic book, or kind of, you know, I know there's still a fan base to this day. I found some websites where people are very passionate about Fantomas, but you know, it just sort of made me think of, like, where you might want to place the story more than 100 years later, now that it's this sort of piece of media from the past.
I kind of think that in this day and age, the only way to go about it is to set it back in its original time period. I think anything less is even more derivative.
Yeah, right. The fun of seeing, like, old Paris and costume balls and stuff like that would be, like, a huge
and
part
fake
of
arms.
The appeal of having a new Fantomas.
Yeah.
you would have to explain to audiences who Fantomas is today, probably. You know, it's like when the John Carter movie came out and people had no idea who that was. You know, these sort of important pulp influential stories. You know, people who are into it might know who it is, but, like, a wider audience is probably not going to have any idea.
And especially in this day and age where everything is, like, IP driven, it's just like, if I've heard of it before, then I will see it.
Right.
The Fantomas movie is just going to have the three of us in the theater.
What if you just, like, marketed it like you would, like, you know, a remake movie now? Like, you just, like, make it, like, everybody who's seeing the trailer assume that they're supposed to know what it is, then everyone sees it so that they, like, don't feel left out.
It's like an Emperor's New Clothes situation. Like, what do you mean you don't know about Fantomas? You didn't grow up watching the 1913 serial? Jeez.
Everyone gets really gatekeepy about Fantomas.
I like this as a marketing strategy. We need to convince the studios we need to convince Gaumont to remake it and market it this way.
Oh, that's something I forgot to mention, is that Fouillade, I found out before he was even directing films. He was like the artistic director for Gaumont, so he was like the go-to guy for all the visual stuff, even for films that he wasn't directing. But he had huge sway, which is, I guess, partly why he made so many things and so many popular things. He had resources at his disposal, and he was kind of like their go-to guy.
And probably why there's so many things that he has the directorial credit for as well.
Right. I mean, sometimes crediting on silent films could be a little bit weird. Have you read Red Rooster Scare?
I have not. Is that about Pathé?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's sort of about like early 20th century films, like how many films from Europe were coming to North America and kind of the American effort to block a bunch of European films and to try to build up their own market. And it's really interesting to kind of see it broken down and talking about some of the xenophobia, but at the same time, like how popular some of these French films were in the States. And
oh yeah,
you know, so
and France had like color techniques that were not available in America, and America's just like, no, you want a black and white image, you don't want that flashy color. And then 1939 comes around, it's like, you don't want that crappy black and white image, you want our fancy Technicolor.
Right. You know, but it's sort of funny to me that like even Fantomas got an American remake, but you know, that means it must have at least been popular internationally. Like, I'm sure it was easy to export. I think like even some of the prints, there might have been some comment on the prints for the new Blu-ray that like, oh, this one came from like Denmark or wherever. Like I think one was like a Czech Fantomas print that they had to redo the intertitles for.
The quality, you know, of the films on the Blu-ray are amazing, especially considering how old they are. Like, a lot of times with older silent films, you'll have one scene that's in like pristine quality and another one that looks like it's been in someone's basement for 3,000 years.
Right. Because sometimes, like, you know, you're desperate just to find like one reel or one scene, and you might have to cobble a bunch of different versions together. Like with Metropolis, I know it's like every couple of years it seems to get a little bit longer.
Yeah. I do know that, especially for the fifth one of the serials, there are a few intertitles that say like, this is describing the scenes that are missing. But I feel like it's the only one where that happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they're in pretty good shape. I'm guessing like because they were serialized and it was episodes and they would have been traveling, there's probably like a lot of versions out there that were probably easy to get a hold of, which might be why that it's in pretty good shape.
And one interesting thing that I learned, a lot of the reason why the French films from this era are gone, probably most of Fouillade's work is completely gone, mm-hmm. is that they would burn them and to get the metal out of the film to be used for the war.
Yeah.
It was more useful that way. It's like, oh, people already watched it, why do they need to see it again?
Yeah. It's always strange to me, like when you hear these stories of like, oh, you know, they found like a new cut of Vampire in, or what was it, Passion of Joan of Arc, they found a copy in like a mental institution.
Yeah, because the original version had been lost, so they just had the B cut. And then the mental institution had the original version for some reason.
It's too weird where things turn out.
Wasn't Miami Connection found in like a castle somewhere for some reason?
Is that true, or is that just?
It was either a castle or a dumpster. I can't remember which.
Was it the only place that they played Miami Connection?
Anyway, so that's Fantomas.
can I just say one last thing about the Fantomas lore that is not in any of the movies, though I wish it was, because it's in one of the books. There is a character that does not exist. It is not a real person. It is a disguise worn by Fantomas and a disguise worn by Juve. So they both decided to portray this person, but never at the same time. So for some reason, our hero and our villain, who are working against each other, play the same person in public. Which makes zero sense whatsoever, but I think perfectly describes Fantomas as a story.
It'd be like if Lex Luthor went out dressed as Clark Kent half the time, like to get away. Like, it's so weird.
You would think that they would need it. Like, all right, we need to have a meeting to talk about our
mutual
secret identity, our mutual disguise.
Our mutual disguise.
Oh my god, I can't believe we're both here at the same time. This is so embarrassing.
Just call me before you wear it.
I will admit I did half expect at the end of the Fantomas serials for Juve to be looking at himself in a mirror and notices a crease at the side of his cheek and pulls it away to find out that he's been Fantomas the whole time.
Well, I, like, I'm not sure how the books formally end, but it seems like the perfect ending for the series would be for them to eventually, like, swap places somehow, and, like, Juve gets executed as Fantomas, and Fantomas just, like, assumes Juve's position, or, like, that would be the kind of ending that, you know, would be sort of a logical place to bring this, I guess.
I don't think it ever got a logical ending, because one of the two dudes died.
Right, I think they kept writing books for a while, and I think there were even, like, unofficial books written after, or, you know, other authors came in and kind of kept working it, but it's like that golden goose thing. You don't want to squeeze to death, so...
But, I mean, they started writing them in 1911. The dude died in 1914. I assume it was the pressure of having to churn out 200 pages of a book every month for 3 years that killed him.
I'm sure.
But I think the appropriate thing to do would be for the other guy in true Fantomas fashion is to say that he's still alive and just wear a disguise as him to keep the series going.
I'm just picturing Fantomas fans, like rabid Game of Thrones fans, like, oh, like, they better finish the books before the movies are done. Like, just going on about stuff.
Fandor did that in that episode. It's not his character.
Clearly the filmmakers weren't paying attention to the novel.
They were just so busy getting ready to do Les Vampires.
Totally downhill, totally. So yeah, I guess that's about it.
I just want to make sure we did give enough attention to the snake-proof pajamas, because I'm wearing those tonight, just in case.
Well, I was going to ask you both what your favorite disguise was.
Fat guy that can steal a bunch of stuff into prison.
That's a good one.
I'm going to say, I had to write down the name. It's Juve's disguise in the third one, when he plays, like, Cranajor or something like that, where it's like, I know how to infiltrate them. I will be a mute, dumb person. They won't even suspect it. He gains almost zero knowledge doing it. He embarrasses and humiliates himself the entire time. And it's to no one's benefit. He just completely degrades himself as a human being, and doesn't even catch Fantomas as a result of it.
It wasn't worth it.
It wasn't. He fakes his own death to be this guy until he meets up with Fandor later. It's like, I'm coming out of my fake deathery to catch Fantomas. Ah, he went through a wall. My family thought I was dead for 3 months for this.
Well, thank you both for coming on this episode to discuss Fantomas, and I don't if there's anywhere people can find you on the internet or anything you want to plug, now's the time. Emma, I don't know if you have anything you want to mention or
nah.
Nah. Okay. Dave, where can folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter at CinemaVsDave. That is Cinema VS Dave.
Folks listening, you can follow me on Twitter at Movie Kessler, and of course be sure to check out the other FlixWise stuff, and be sure to tune in next episode, same Fantomas time, same Fantomas channel.